analogy. Now, this is the problem of religious language. And the problem of religious language is our language about God, let's be more specific, is the biblical language, what the Bible teaches about God, is that univocal, equivocal, or analogical? Only three choices. Univocal means entirely the same, equivocal means entirely different, and analogical means similar. So is our talk about God univocal, equivocal, or analogical? Let's take the three alternatives and first of all talk about the analogy of being, the ontological aspect. Either being is that which is reality, either being is univocal, equivocal, or analogical. If being is univocal, that means being is entirely the same. Now, what if every being in the universe is entirely the same? How many beings do we have?
One.
One. Monism. Anybody not see that? If every being is entirely the same, no difference, remember Parmenides, what would he say? To differ by nothing is not to differ at all. So if every being is entirely the same, then you only have one being. Now, what if being were univocal? What if it was entirely different? And suppose this pencil is being, and everything else is entirely different. What would everything else be?
Non-being.
So how many beings do we have? One. So whether being is understood univocally or equivocally, you can only have one being in a universe. So monism results from accepting the univocity or equivocity of being. The only way you can have two beings in a universe, and theism demands that there be at least two beings, God and a creature, is to have an analogy of being, to have similar beings. God is being and I have being. God has been infinitely and I have been finitely. You can have two beings that way. But if you can't have two infinite beings entirely the same. So theism demands pluralism, and pluralism demands analogy of being. Conclusion, either monism or analogy. Either become a pantheist or accept some kind of analogy of being. Secondly, analogy of language. This is the epistemological aspect. First of all, let's talk about the univocity of concepts, and secondly, the analogy of judgments. I believe that Scotus and Occam, who stressed univocity, were correct when talking about concepts. I believe Aquinas was correct when talking about judgments. And so you can reconcile the two medieval traditions by the following distinction. Whenever we are defining a term, we must define it entirely the same way when we use it of God and we use it of man. For instance, if I am going to call God good and John good, and I'm going to use the same term good to apply to both God and man, I cannot use the term good in an equivocal way. I can't say good means this when it applies to John and means something entirely different when it applies to God, because then there is no connection at all. So let's suppose we define good as that which is desired for its own sake. That which is desirable for its own sake. You don't desire it for the sake of something else, it's just intrinsically desirable. That which is desirable for its own sake. You define good that way. Now we got a univocal definition. I'm not going to change it. I'm going to say there's something about John that is desirable for his own sake. He's an end, not a means. He's a person, an I, not an it. And that's true. John is good. Now I take this term and I don't change the definition. There's something about God, which he's desirable for his own sake. Then change the definition. God is intrinsically desirable. John has some intrinsic value. So far, so good. We defined it univocally. However, I did not apply it to God in the same way. Because if I apply that term to God in the same way in which I apply it to John, I either blasphemed God, or I finitize God or something, because God is infinitely good and John is only finitely good. So I have to make a difference in the way I apply it. I apply it to John in accordance with his being, and his being is finite. I apply it to God in accordance with his being, and his being is infinite. So my concept is the same, but my judgment is different. My definition is the same, but my application is different. That's what Aquinas was talking about under the analogy of judgment, and Scotus was talking about the univocity of concept. They were both right, but like ships passing in the night. Now let's give the argument for Scotus' view, 2a, that concepts must be univocal. Equivocity leaves one in skepticism. Analogy leaves one in skepticism. Why? Well, we know why equivocity does, because the terms are used entirely different way. But if we say, my term is defined analogously, in every analogous thing, there is always a similar element and a different element. You say, well, give me what the similar element is. Well, I can't tell you. If I can't tell you what the similar element is, I leave you in skepticism. I got to give the same definition. Good is that which is desirable for its own sake. If I don't give you that same definition, and I'm not willing to point to the univocal element, then I've never shown you the similarity. If I never show you a similarity, I leave you with difference. But if I show you a similarity, then I've given you a univocal element. And once I give you the univocal element, it's no longer analogous. It's univocal. So Scotus is right in saying that if you give an analogy, if you define terms analogously, there must be a similar element. If you can't identify the similar element, people are left in skepticism. If you can define the similar element, you just gave them the univocal concept. So concepts used of God and man must be univocally defined. On the other hand, Aquinas is right, 2b, that you cannot apply things to God either equivocally or univocally, because if you apply a term good to God equivocally, you say John is good, and God is entirely different from that, then you don't know what God is. If you apply them to God univocally, and you end up in some kind of dogmatism that we have a one-to-one correspondence between our ideas and the way God is, and that my language is identical to the way God thinks, either my language is infinite or he is finite because he thinks infinitely and I think finitely, so you end up in some kind of dogmatism or self-deification. Therefore, analogy is the only alternative. Similar. We apply terms to God in a similar way. For example, being, that which is, means the same, univocal concept, but it is applied, analogy of judgment, only similarly to an infinite being and to a finite being. Because God has been infinitely and John has it finitely, we don't apply the term in the same way. Now, before we justify or give the basis for analogy, any questions on points one or two?
Why equivocal leads to monism?
Yeah. Because that was the pen illustration. Because if this is being, and equivocal means totally different, then what is totally different from being? Non-being. So this is the only being. Everything else is non-being. Analogy of judgment is talking about predication, second act of the intellect. Apprehension is the first act of the intellect. Remember Aristotle and Aquinas. You apprehend by the first act of the intellect, you judge. Apprehension is, let's say you apprehend tree. That's the subject. Judgment is, tree is green. Now you're making an affirmation. As soon as you put that is in there and you're applying it, you're making a judgment. Now you got to ask, how are you applying it? Are you applying it without limits or with limits? You applying it infinitely or finitely? You applying it necessarily or contingently? And once you do that, then obviously when it comes to God, you have to apply terms to him differently because he's a different kind of being. You apply them to the being in accordance with the kind of being they are.
God is an infinite, necessary, immutable being, so you say God is immutable good. John is a mutable being, so you say John is a mutable good. Judgment means apply. Univocal concept means definition. You define the terms the same way, but you apply them differently. Anything else on one or two? No, it's making a predication. It's making an affirmation. It's not adding adjectives. It is actually making a statement or predication. It is now saying this attribute is now being applied to this being. And you take any given attribute, which applies to man and applies to God, and they have to be applied differently. But you can't change their definition or you don't know what you're applying. Thirdly, the basis of analogy. The ontological basis, or the basis in reality, is the creator-creature relationship. The reason we can do that, the reason we can talk about God, is because God created the world, and the world is similar to Him. The reason we can talk about God is because God is pure act, and He made something that is actual. Also, could potentially not be, but act communicates act. Being produces being, and there's an intrinsic causal connection. He can't give what he hasn't got to give. Neither can he give the condition under which he has it, because he has it infinitely, and you can't give an infinite condition, so it has potency. But on this level here, there has to be a similarity between creation and creature. It's not accidental. It's not God sat down and said, I think I'll create something. Should I create it totally different than me, or should I create it totally the same me, or should I create it similar to me? God didn't have those choices. He couldn't create something totally different than being, because that's non-being, and you can't create non-being. You can't bring to be what doesn't be. He couldn't create it totally the same, because you can't make another God. So the only kind of thing he could do is create a world that was similar to him. There's no other option. You want me to run through that again? Or do you have any question about it? The very fact that we are creation and he is creator shows an analogy right there in the relationship. The epistemological discovery of this, how do we learn about this? Well, you could learn about it by revelation from God to man, or by reason from man to God. Both use analogy. If you talk to presuppositionalists, they will tell you that you can only know God by way of special revelation. And one of the reasons they give is that you can't argue from effect to cause. That's an illegitimate argument. You've got to start from the top and work your way down. You can't start from the bottom and work your way up. Well, that is not a good argument, because they start from effect to cause. The Bible is an effect. They start with special revelation, which is an effect of God, and they say God is similar to this effect. So it doesn't matter whether you're presuppositionalist or not, you're still arguing from effect to cause. We argue from general revelation. Aquinas, Augustine, Anselm, and those in the traditional apologetics argue from general revelation and effect to God. They argue from special revelation and effect to God. Both are arguing from effect to cause. And if there were no similarity between the effect and the cause, they wouldn't know God anymore, because they had special revelation. What we mean by image is not the equivalent, but the image of God is one of the manifestations of the cause-effect relationship. Now, we happen to have more things that are like God than a stone does. But a stone is also like God. If a stone exists, it's like God. Name one way in which a stone is like God. It exists. It's got being. He has being. Now, there may be more, too, and I won't take the time to unpack. It has stability. He has stability. I mean, you can, and it's used often in the Bible as a metaphor of God. Okay, Roman numeral 4. The kinds of analogy. There are two kinds of analogy, extrinsic and intrinsic. Extrinsic analogy is where only one of the two things possesses the characteristic really and the other one doesn't actually possess it. For example, let's say the cause possesses it but the effect doesn't. Or the effect might possess it and the cause doesn't. But one of the two, either the cause or the effect, does not possess the characteristic. Only one of them really possesses the characteristic and the other one doesn't. Example, food is called healthy because it causes health in the body. So here you have food and here you have a body. And the body, it is proper to call the body healthy. There are healthy bodies and unhealthy bodies. And we say, that was healthy food because it caused health in the body. But health is not a proper characteristic of food. It's just attributed to food and should be really put in quotes. We call that, quote, healthy food. It's called healthy only because it caused health, not because it is healthy. Food is not healthy or unhealthy, technically speaking. Bodies are healthy and unhealthy. But if the food causes good health, we call it good food or healthy food. But health does not properly apply to food. It only properly applies to the body. So only one of the two, in this case the effect, has the characteristic. I can change it. Here is hot water. And here is a hard egg. Now obviously, hardness is caused by the hot water, but hardness is not possessed by hot water. Hot water is not hard. So again, you've got something that properly belongs here in the effect. Hardness that is not here, and therefore there would be only an extrinsic causal relationship between them. And remember when we studied Plotinus, he said the one causes the nous. The one causes mind, but does not have mind. That would be an extrinsic causal relationship. And we studied Kant, he said the noumena causes the phenomena, but the noumena is not like the phenomena. That's an extrinsic causal relationship. Okay, any question about extrinsic causal relationship? The cause produces what it doesn't possess. The characteristic in the effect is not properly in the cause. Yes, it's either material cause or part of the condition of receiving the causality. So it wouldn't be only a material cause, it could be part of the condition of receiving it.
Well, I was wondering in terms of Plotinus' argument about the mind coming from non-mind being, coming from the beyond being, if it's not, if it doesn't receive it extrinsically, then where does it come from? If it's from the material, then being didn't come from non-being.
Yeah. Well, once you deny intrinsic causality, that's the kind of contradictions you'll land in. All right, the second kind of causality, B, we're under 4B now, that was extrinsic, is intrinsic, and this is where both things, both cause and effect, possess the characteristic properly. And that would be in intrinsic causality, that would be what Aquinas believes in Augustine and all, that being causes being. Let's make a small b here. Capital B causes small b. An infinite being causes finite being. Or pure act causes act potency. There's an intrinsic causal connection between the cause and the effect. The cause is giving to the effect a characteristic that properly belongs to the effect by nature of what it is, and it properly belongs to the cause.
Does the potential part of that belong in the
Yeah, that, there's an extrinsic relationship between act and potency, and there's an intrinsic relationship between act and act. Now, in this kind of relationship, you have a proper analogy. This equals proper analogy, and that's what we're talking about, a correct analogy, because you have a true essential relationship between the giver and the gift, between the cause and the effect. And that's the kind of connection there is between God and the world. That's the kind of connection there is between God and His Word. His Word is not Him. We don't worship the Bible. But His Word truly expresses Him in analogous terms. He has to accommodate Himself, i.e., adapt Himself. He has to adapt Himself to finitude to do it, but it is really an expression of God in the Bible. It can't be identical to Him because it is finite language and it participates in finitude by virtue of being finite language, but it does not necessitate error. Roman numeral number 5. Let us explain, this will be analogy explained, let's explain what kind of analogy we're talking about here and what kind we are not. A. When we say that there is an analogy between God and man, we are talking about an analogy that is causal, not non-causal. We're talking about an analogy that is based on dependence, not based on dualism. That was the problem in Plato. He's got the formless out here, and he's got the former up here. Now, when you have these both exist forever, and they're two different things, and the former didn't make the formless, you've got a dualism, you've got a parallelism, and it's going to be almost impossible, I think impossible, to ever make an analogy between them. That's why the formless is ugly and the form is beautiful. And you've really got opposites. You have this constant dualistic opposite because there is no creative connection between the former and the formless. But in Christianity, Judeo-Christian God created the first lump of clay. God created matter. And so there is a similarity between matter and God. It's, of course, different, too. Matter exists. God exists. Matter has energy. God has energy, to just mention two of them. Matter, as we know it, has finite, limited energy. God doesn't. Therein is the difference. But you can't have, when we're talking about analogy, we're talking about a causally connected analogy, where the creation depends on the creator, and therefore there's an analogous relationship between them, not a dualistic one. Secondly, we're talking, as we said, about an intrinsic analogy, not an extrinsic analogy. So point B is the proper analogy is intrinsic, not extrinsic. It is real, not merely stipulative. It is not we stipulate food is healthy because it caused is healthy, even though food isn't healthy, is that the cause, God, really is good because He causes good. Thirdly, or C, this analogy is essential, not accidental. It is per se, not per accidens. The analogy between God and creation is essential analogy. It's what they really are by nature, not in anything they are accidentally. Fourth, and this is a very important one, that we are talking about an efficient cause, not an instrumental cause. The only kind of cause with which there is an analogous relationship is an efficient cause, not an instrumental cause. The instrumental cause may or may not be related, may or may not be similar to the cause, but an efficient cause is always similar to an effect. For instance, the relationship between my mind and my book is an analogous intrinsic relationship. There must be a similarity between my mind and my book. There need not be a similarity between my pen and my mind. because the pen is only an instrumental cause that I use to write the book. So I could, if I were real clever, make a book in the shape of a pen, but that would be accidental. It is not accidental that the book expresses my mind, because my mind is the cause of the book, and there's an essential relationship between mind and book, only an accidental relationship, or rather instrumental, between the pen and my mind. So the student's exam will look like his mind, it will not necessarily look like his fountain pen. Then, finally, you think I'm optimistic? It is an efficient cause, not a material cause. There is no necessary connection between a material cause, no necessary analogy between a material cause, or material effect, rather, and a cause. There is a necessary relationship between an efficient cause and its effect. And these are the many illustrations we've used. While hot water produces a hot egg, it also produces a hard egg. And the hard egg is due to the material nature of the effect. The hotness is act, communicating act. The hardness is act, which also produces potency when it's producing act. So that is, you cannot look at the material nature of the effect and say it must be similar to the cause, but you can look at the actual nature of the effect and say it is similar to the efficient cause. Because the same sun that melts clay, melts wax, hardens clay. But both of them produce heat. The sun, hot, produces heat in wax and clay. It softens one, it hardens one. That's due to the material nature of the effect, not due to the actual communication of act from the actor to the effect.